My name is Bryant Garth, and I am the interim executive director of the American Bar Foundation. You say interim. Well, I turned back into a pumpkin on August 31st, and my successor is here, and I am so happy that it's Laura Beth Nielsen. Put your hand up. Okay, welcome to the ABF Fellows CLE. Our program this morning, to let you know you're in the right place, is entitled The Afterlife of Mass Incarceration. Before I introduce our moderator for today's panel discussion, I want to take just a moment, as always, to say a few words about the important work of the American Bar Foundation. For those of you who might not be familiar, the American Bar Foundation is an independent, nonprofit research institute that is preparing to celebrate its 75th anniversary next year. For nearly 75 years, the ABF has brought together a community of leading scholars conducting long-term, empirical, and interdisciplinary research dedicated to helping us better understand the ways law and society interact. And of course, this work would not be possible without the support of many of you who are the fellows of the ABF. Your donations as fellows helps to sustain the ABF's mission, and we are truly thankful. Fellows also serve, and you will take this out into your world as ambassadors helping disseminate the research to their courtrooms, classrooms, and communities in order to change policy that affects our justice system. The whole premise of the ABF is that you need solid data based on in-depth and independent research, like we do at the ABF. So thank you for your support, your leadership, and being here this morning. And now, before Jennifer Parent introduces our other panelists, I want to say a few words about her. She is the director of the litigation department and chair of the business litigation practice group at McLean Middleton in Manchester, New Hampshire, where she has spent more than three decades representing businesses in complex commercial and employment litigation. She's a nationally respected leader in the legal profession, as you know, having served as president of the New Hampshire Bar Association, the National Conference of Bar Presidents, the New England Bar Association, and the New Hampshire Women's Bar Association. She is also a fellow of the American College of Trial Lawyers and currently serves as chair of the American Bar Association House of Delegates Committee on Rules and Calendar. As National Chair of the American Bar Foundation Fellows, Jennifer is dedicated to advancing the foundation's mission, supporting its groundbreaking research, and strengthening the nationwide community of fellows. One more. Jennifer has been a fellow of the American Bar Foundation since 2006 and is currently a patron fellow. We are so grateful for Jennifer's support over the years and thrilled to have her preside over this panel. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning. All right, I have the pleasure of introducing you to the two panelists who are incredible. Read both their books, and hopefully you will walk away having read, if you haven't read them, both of them. So I'm going to introduce you to our first panelist, Reuben Jonathan Miller. He's a sociologist, criminologist, and social worker who is a professor at the University of California, Berkeley. He's formerly at the University of Chicago in the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice. He's also an ABF research professor, and he has been a member of the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton and a fellow at both the New America Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation. He was also a visiting scholar at the University of Texas at Austin and at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. I told him I had to get New Hampshire in there somewhere. Professor Miller comes to this work as more than a scholar. He began his career counseling children in foster care, then served as a volunteer chaplain at Chicago's Cook County Jail. And he writes as the son and brother of incarcerated men. His acclaimed book, Halfway Home, Race, Punishment, and the Afterlife of Mass Incarceration, draws on roughly 15 years of interviewing some 250 people to reveal a hard truth that for millions of Americans, life after prison is its own form of prison. Introducing our second panelist, Calvin Duncan, and I promise you, his story, if you haven't heard it yet, will stay with you long after today. At 19, Calvin was wrongly convicted of a New Orleans murder and sentenced to life. He would spend more than 28 years inside prison, much of it at Louisiana's notorious Angola prison. With a ninth grade education, Calvin taught himself the law, and at 21, he filed his first motion, a motion for a law book, which is in front of you, and went on to serve as inmate counsel, also referred to as jailhouse lawyer, helping hundreds of fellow prisoners challenge their convictions, and his work has contributed to landmark Supreme Court decisions, including Ramos versus Louisiana and Smith versus Kane. Released in 2011 and later exonerated, Calvin went on to earn his law degree at 60 years old. In his memoir, The Jailhouse Lawyer details that incredible story. So first, I will say, please welcome Ruben to the stage.
Thank you so much, Jennifer, for the introduction. And it's just an honor to be on the panel with you both, especially Calvin. Like, it's just a great honor. What you've accomplished, both inside and out, is breathtaking.
Thank you. You know,
yeah, so important for us. And thank you for coming. You could be at another panel. You know, there are many things for you to do today. You could be doing other things, but you're hanging out with us, and so for that, we're grateful. I'm an ethnographer primarily, meaning I do participant observation, and along with that, I'll do interview-based work too, where I follow people for many years. And Jennifer mentioned that the book that I'm presenting is drawn from 250 or so interviews with formerly incarcerated men, their families, their children. The ethnographic portion of the work has to do with kind of using your body to understand the experiences of other people, so you do what they do. I spent 3.5 years in halfway houses on the south and west sides of Chicago, and I spent 2 years following formerly incarcerated activists across, as they did campaigns to change the law and policy apparatus that hemmed them in places as far-flung as L.A. and New York, Ypsilanti, Michigan, certainly Chicago, and many, many larger and smaller cities in between. And then I spent about 2 years in Detroit following people as a part of this kind of health study. And so the work that I'm presenting is the culmination of three projects conducted over many years. The interviews took place over a really long period of time. Some people I followed the interviews took place over about 15 years, and some people I followed for up to 13. That was the longest person that I followed from their time going into prison until release. But anyway, so to start my presentation, I just wanted to sort of tell you about the work that went into the project, because I'm going to mostly tell you stories. But I want to start the presentation with a really famous graph. And so for people who study crime and punishment, this is probably the most famous graph. This is the graph of the incarceration rate. In this graph, we go from 1900 to about 2024. And you'll see right around 1972, the graph starts to tick up. And so from 1972 to 2009, we incarcerate more people at a faster rate than we did the year before, and we do that for 27 straight years. So from 1972 to 2009, more people than the year before at a faster rate than the year before. We go from about 300,000 people in an American jail or prison to well over 2 million. Now, this is a fairly familiar story to many people in the room, but it's important to know that we were keeping pace with our colleagues in Western Europe. We had an incarceration rate that mirrored Norway or Sweden. This is the United States. That the prison count was so low that administrators in the Nixon administration, that officials in the Nixon administration were circulating a memo titled, "Are Prisons Obsolete?" Are prisons obsolete? This becomes the title of Angela Davis's, one of Angela Davis's books. And then we decide in 1972 that we want to change course. Rehabilitation has died, we say. This is in part, well, many reasons. You know, there's this the three great forces that converge. There's the racial terrors of the 1960s and our fear of vast social change. That's the standard story, and it's a very important story. That we see a backlash from so much gain from the civil rights movement. That's a very important part of the story. There's another part. We also see the backlash against government intervention in the lives of people at all. We see the emergence of other kinds of knowledge that say government is in fact inefficient. Evidence-based medicine is on the scene for the first time. You get an all-out attack on public welfare, help for the poor. And then you have a real crime wave that happens in the 1970s, not the 1960s. So it happens after we start, not before. And that crime wave is cyclical, like all crime waves are. This is mass incarceration. The mass in mass incarceration, of course, has to do with race, because mass incarceration is not just a criminal justice issue, it's a series of crises. In fact, it is a racial justice crisis. We know this for sure. The mass of mass incarceration, according to the sociologist David Garland, who brings the word mass imprisonment into sort of popular parlance, he borrows that term from Japanese internment and other forms of what we would call mass incarceration that happened prior, but it becomes really popular in about 2001. Anyway, the mass in mass incarceration stands for poor black men. To get at poor black men, what they did was they looked at educational attainment. So they said, okay, what's the likelihood that someone who's born poor and black and male in this country will go to jail and prison? We don't have good data on income. We'll look at their education data because it's better, it's sharper, it's crisper. We can drill down in a more powerful way. And they found that 60% of black boys who dropped out of high school would wind up in a jail or prison at some point in their lifetime, and 30% of black graduates. It is a racial justice crisis. Black people are 5 times more likely to be incarcerated and twice as likely to be arrested for the same crimes when you control for criminal offense, meaning when people have done the same thing, when they've got the same criminal history. If you're a poor black boy, you're 5 times more likely to go to jail or prison than if you're a poor white boy. It's a racial justice crisis. But it's not just that. It's also a public health crisis. We knew before the COVID pandemic that people inside American jails or prisons experienced premature death in ways that we would find incredible. HIV prevalence was 5 times higher inside a jail or prison. Hepatitis C, 9 times higher. Somewhere between 12 and 35% of all individuals with a communicable disease passed through a jail or prison in the year before it expressed itself in the general population. We've known this since 2009. This isn't new data, new information. We knew that the prison was a death trap long before COVID. Recent scholars have found for every year someone spends in an American jail or prison, they lose 2 years off their life expectancy. 2 years for every year they spend inside. I can't tell you how many of the brothers I followed over time who had been out for a year, year and a half, 2 years, and died from many things, cancer, heart attacks, stroke. All the expressions of poor health show up inside jails or prisons that exacerbated race. This makes sense. I mean, you know, folks are surviving on ramen noodles, right? I mean, Calvin can speak to this. I much more powerfully than I ever could. There's a rapidly aging population in American jails or prisons. is negative mental health outcomes in American jails and prisons, because the American jail and prison system is also a mental health crisis. It is a series of crises. 15% of people in prison, 20% of people in jail experience some sort of diagnosable serious mental illness. What does this mean for the ones we don't catch? For folks whose the terrible prison intake assessment captures mental health issues in 15 to 20% of the population. Jails and prisons are the largest mental health providers in 44 out of 50 states in our country now. But it's also a crisis of disability. 38% of people incarcerated experience a disability. Some of that's ambulatory, some of that's cognitive. There's a lot of hearing loss. A lot of folks lose sight. It's a homelessness crisis. If you've spent time in an American jail or prison, you're seven times more likely to experience homelessness if you've ever been locked up. And if you've been locked up more than once, you're 13 times more likely to experience homelessness than members of the general population. Black women were the most housing insecure of all formerly incarcerated people. It is a homelessness crisis. It is a crisis of housing insecurity. And so the question that I ask is our response to crime, is mass incarceration the way we've responded? So even though the chart has dipped, the number of people have gone down, we're hovering around 2 million people right now. So at its peak, there were 2.4 million people in an American jail or prison. Right now, it's gone down a little bit. They're about 2 million. We say that we arrest people because we're afraid of them. We say we arrest people because it's a response to crime. My question is, given what we know, is this a response to crime and violence, or is this about vulnerability and our inability to care for the most vulnerable among us? But the prison isn't just where the action is. This is a bar graph that I'm just trying to show you a set of relationships, or at least the relationship between the prison or jail, people who are currently incarcerated, the 2 or so million people who are locked away in an American jail or prison, and every other form of carceral control. And so we see that people on probation or parole eclipses the number of people held inside. They're close to 5 million people on probation or parole right now. If you switch the unit of analysis from a point in time count, meaning the number of people who are in a facility on any given day, to the number of people processed through a facility. So for folks who are statisticians in the room, it's not a fair thing to do. However, it makes a good graph, and that's why I'm doing it. So anyway, so if you switch the point in time count, right, you think about people processed through an institution. I think it's meaningful, though. You'll see that the jail processes close to 10 million people a year. At its height, it was close to 12. If we switch the unit of analysis again, if we follow our scholars who have used life tables using the same methods that folks who work for insurance companies use to calculate risk, the risk of death, the risk of mortality, so they try to figure out the survival rate. How many people are alive who've had a set of experiences? So if you shift the unit of analysis yet again, and you say, how many people are alive who've been through a prison, which is to say, how many people alive have a felony record, we see that there are 19 million Americans who have a felony record. This number is 10 times the size of the US jail or prison system, but gets the least attention. One more disturbing fact of American life are the number of people who have criminal records at all. The Bureau of Justice Statistics in 2014 counted the number of people with any kind of criminal record. And they reduced the number because they overcounted it first. After reducing their number, they found 80 million Americans have a criminal record of some sort. A full third of all U.S. adults have some sort of criminal record. It tells me that communities where the action is, and the prison, despite its place in the public's imagination, is one relatively small slice of the pie. That what we've done is we've inaugurated a vast carceral network, a vast carceral network that touches almost every American. One in two Americans has a loved one who's done time. Now, it is racially disparate. This doesn't say this isn't a racial story. It is partially a racial story, powerfully a racial story. one in two black women have a loved one that's right now sitting in a cage. One in two. But so too do one in eight white women. If you let every black person go, it is a powerfully racial story. It is, in my estimation, a racist story. People do more time for the same crimes. 20% longer sentences in federal court, 10% longer sentences from the state bench. That is a racial story. That is a racist story, in my imagination. But if you let every black person go, we'd have a million people in prison, and they'd all be white. 38% of the U.S. prison population is white. There was a study that showed, I'm going longer than I thought. Are we good on time? There was a study that showed that by the time a black boy turns 23, that 49% of black boys who turn 23 in this country will be arrested. Half of black boys in this country will be arrested. That same study told us that 38% of white boys will be arrested. But because we associate black people with crime and black people with violence, that when we think about criminal justice or criminal justice reform, we think it's only a racial story. But what I say is, what you built for my children affect yours. We live together. We'll all be eaten by this thing. You can't convince me that a third of American families are bad people. You can't convince me. So what does this look like, but also what does it feel like? I'll talk to you about what it looks like. We'll stay about 30,000 feet in the air where we are right now, but maybe we'll come down. Maybe we'll come down to about 5,000 feet in the air, and we'll think about national policy, and we'll think about state policy. This is a screenshot of a national inventory of the collateral consequences of a criminal conviction. I believe the American Bar Association funded this initial study, and folks went around and counted the number of laws, policies, and administrative sanctions that target people with criminal records. So on the one hand, we talked about the vulnerable as the input. Now I want to talk about the law and policy mechanisms that work with the vulnerability in really particular ways. Let's talk about it for a second. So when they counted, the first time they counted the number of laws and policies and administrative sanctions that target people with records, they counted 48,000 laws, policies, administrative sanctions that target people with criminal records. There's been reforms, there was double counting, et cetera. So today we know that there are about 44,000. Now the devil's always in the empirical details. In a state like Illinois, they're 1,400. In New York State, they're like 970-something. In Little Vermont, they're 600 or 700. Texas has about 1,300. I mean, the devil's always in the empirical details. But what these law and policy mechanisms mean is they mean exclusion, wholesale exclusion from entire categories of employment. There are entire categories of employment for which one need not apply. In the state of Illinois, you could have been trained as a barber, but it took a legislative change in 2016 to allow people who were trained as a barber to be barbers and get barber's licenses. You couldn't groom a dog in the state of Illinois if you had a violent, for example, a felony. You could lose custody of your children. There's a lot of attention to voting rights, and voting rights are really important. Voting rights are also always on the table. So one state, Virginia, permanently bans voting rights for people who've done time. Three states have permanent bans for some felony convictions, some crimes of violence. 15 states say you must complete supervision, probation, or parole. You may famously remember what happened in Florida. There was a big proposition that allowed people who had been disenfranchised because of their felony records to get the right to vote, and then the governor with colleagues in the courts reversed that by saying you must complete probation or parole, you must pay all fines and fees, this kind of thing. Colorado is one of 24 states that restore rights after incarceration automatically. And just two states, Vermont and Maine, have no disenfranchisement. And so we see across the country that there's some limits on the ability to vote. This matters because there are some limits on the ability for people to find representation that reflects their wants, their values, this kind of thing. You know, in most states, you can't sit on a jury even if you've had a felony record. What I suggest is this is the legal production of vulnerability. In most states, you can't hold public office. I mentioned you couldn't groom a dog or be a barber in my state until about 2016. You may not adopt or foster a child. You may have to give up your parental rights. You may not live in public housing. Your job applications can be denied. You may be fired or evicted on a whim. Your relationships look fundamentally different. And so I'm taking just a bit longer than I anticipated, but I'd like to tell you a story. So we were at 5,000 feet, and we talked about the legal apparatus in specific states. And now I'd like to bring you to the ground, and I'd like to tell you a story about a man who's walking through this experience of the legal production of vulnerability, living in what I write about as a supervised society. This brother, his name is Jimmy. And so I meet Jimmy on the coldest day of the year. It's in Detroit, 2014. It's February. It's one of those days where you see your breath. So I'm about to meet him, and we're going to meet at the bus station, the Rosa Parks bus terminal. This is because Detroit's public transportation system is not great. They have this strange hub system where you kind of come in and then shoot out. So you come into the center and then you shoot out. So it takes 18 hours to get in. Anyway, but so I'm meeting Jimmy at the Rosa Parks transit station, and I see him, and he's got on a thin, worn black skull cap. He's got on a Detroit Tigers baseball jacket that's a little worn. He has no scarf, no gloves, and we're walking, and it's this very cold day. And I have a coffee, and I regret having a coffee because I don't want the coffee to spill on my hands. It's one of these days, and of course it does, and of course I throw it away. And I'm walking with Jimmy, and the whole time I'm walking with Jimmy, we have to get to his next appointment. So his next appointment is a half-hour walk from the Rosa Parks Transit Center to the Workforce Development Center that he's made to go to because of what are called conditions of release. This is a sheet of paper that's handed to you and walk out of prison. We talked about the 44,000 laws, policies, administrative sanctions. These are laws for people with records that they have to follow that aren't codified in any state as formal law. But if you violate any of these, if you don't go to workforce development, if you don't take drug tests, if you don't go to AA meetings, if you don't check in with your parole officer, if you congregate with people with known felony records, these are all reasons that you can have your parole revoked. And something like anywhere from 8 to 24% of all people, of all prison admissions, are because of parole revocations every year. So it's not an insignificant number. Anyway, here's Jimmy. He's required to report to workforce development, and I'm walking with him for this half hour. And the whole time, he's trying to make me feel comfortable. He says, "I really enjoy spending time with a brother like you. I really just want to do something positive." He cracks jokes about Chicago and how violent it is. I'm like, "Man, you're from Detroit. This isn't even comparable. Like, what are we talking?" Anyway, that's my chauvinism. And I wondered why he did that. And then when we got to the Workforce Development Center, I understood. On the front of the Workforce Development Center was a printout that was taped to the door because the entire building was closed. Not one of the offices, not out for lunch, here's the 15 minutes, we'll be back. The building itself was closed, as in shut down, as in no lights. And the nearest Workforce Development Center, a place where he was made to go, had to go by his parole officer at the threat of reincarceration, because if he doesn't make his meetings, he can be reincarcerated, was a 9-mile walk from where we were. Jimmy didn't have bus fare because I gave him bus fare. I gave him a bus card for participating in my interviews. He couldn't call any of the numbers on the center because he had run out of minutes on his cell phone. This was 2014. There were still minute plans. Everybody was making phone calls between 7 p.m. and the next day or whatever. Jimmy needed me in ways that he wouldn't have needed me otherwise had he not been excluded from the political economy and culture. He depended on the goodwill of others. In this case, a well-meaning a social scientist who was following him around. So I decided to help. I said, okay, tell you what, let's walk back the half hour, you jump in my car, and then we'll drive to the next workforce development center. So we drove the 9 miles through Detroit traffic, and for some reason, a city that lost 1 million residents has awful traffic. And we get there, and when we get there, they don't have room for him either. They tell him to put his name on a list in case the parolee fails to show up the following week. And he could hopefully take a slot. We grabbed brochures, we went to Coney Island, this diner chain throughout the city, and we sat down and commiserated on our day over eggs with hair in them, a lukewarm cup of coffee, and he had some bacon. He told me over and over again in that conversation how much he appreciated me. And when I asked him why, like, why do you keep saying this to me? In part because I'm from Chicago, and if you compliment me too much, I get a little edgy. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't trust you. I don't know what you're on. Like, what's happening here? And he said, thank you for being there for me. Being there. But what did I do? I mean, I gave him a ride. Certainly. You know? But even with my help, and perhaps he might not have made it to the center, but even with my help, he didn't get the services that he was required to take at the threat of rearrest. And he would have to explain this to his parole officer, who, depending on the day that he had, may or may not believe him. And look at the story that he'd have to tell. He'd have to say, yeah, me and my guy from, I was working at the University of Michigan, walked a half hour and the center was closed, it wasn't open. Then we got in his car, we drove and it wasn't there. And that's why I missed my appointment. That's why I was late for my movement time. That's an incredible story. Why would you believe Jimmy? Jimmy lived in a supervised society. He had to navigate what I write about as an economy of favors, where he has to elicit favors from well-meaning even strangers to meet his basic human needs. Maybe I'll say the last thing, I'll wrap up this section on Jimmy and tell you about the last time I met with him. It's about a year later, the study has ended. I'm connecting with Jimmy and I'm asking him about the women who are most important in his life. He has a pastor who used to write him letters while he was on the inside, and she would end every letter saying, I await the day until we're united. It was quite beautiful. It was a real source of strength for him. He had a sister who treated him poorly. That's a longer story. He had a girlfriend who he thought he needed and needed a place to stay. That's another story. But what I will tell you about is his relationship with his mother. And so I asked him about his mom because she was a really sweet woman when I met her. And I asked him, when was the last time he talked to her? And he says, oh, I don't really talk to her much. I don't come around her like that. And I asked him why. And he told me the last time he had talked to her, she told him that she could stay with him. Now, Jimmy, at this moment in his life, was very housing insecure. He was sleeping in abandoned buildings. These were buildings that were being rehabbed. His old dope dealer had turned real estate developer and let him stay in the buildings. And so Jimmy was kind of in these soon to be rehabbed homes. It's the winter, it's Detroit. And I asked him about his mother and he says he doesn't come around her. He says the last time she demanded that I stay with her, which was wonderful. And so she slept on his couch. But he said that her landlord had come around and had told her that he saw Jimmy moving about the premises and he knew he had a record. And he told her that if she let him stay with her again, that she would be evicted. This, of course, is the Drug Enforcement Act of 1987, which says that if you so much as allow someone to visit your home who has a criminal record, that you can be evicted. Jimmy stayed away from his mother, the one person who could help him, the one person who would be happy to help him, because he knew she would help him. And if she did, she would put herself at risk. This is the world that people with records have to navigate, a world of deep vulnerability, a world of insecurity, a world of legally produced precarity. So I've tried to, in my work, ask different kinds of questions. I try to ask different kinds of questions empirically. You know, what do we count? Who do we follow? Why does counting things or measuring things in new ways matter? I've tried to ask different kinds of theoretical questions. You know, what does it mean to live under these conditions? What does it tell us about the state of the American Democratic Project? What does it tell us about ourselves? But I think the question that we're facing is an ethical question. I don't think it's an empirical or a theoretical question. I think that we've inaugurated a supervised society. I think if we let every prisoner free today, we'd still have it. The question for us is, what kind of society do we want? Thank you.
So we'll welcome our second panelist, Calvin Duncan.
Okay, thank you. Well, thank you all for being here, and thank you for inviting me, and thank you for being on this great panel. So if I sound excited and enthusiastic about law and being a lawyer, my presentation with you would know why. So I grew up knowing two things, and my whole community just about grew up knowing that two things was going to happen to us. We was going to go to prison at a young age or get killed at a young age. I messed up my life when I was 14 years old I was shoplifting for clothes. I would shoplift for all kind of things to help on my sister as well, but I got busted trying to shoplift for clothes, and they took this mugshot. And I always say, had I not I got busted, had not I been shoplifting, I wouldn't have had this mugshot. And like 4 or 5 years later, a murder happened. A young girl and her boyfriend was at a bus stop. Two guys approached them, wind up killing the young man, and a young lady witnessed her boyfriend being killed. No suspects, they reenacted the crime. And according to the government case, somebody called and said that it was a Negro male named Calvin Duncan. Well, I'm black, and my name is Calvin Duncan. And she identified my mugshot. Now, had not I had that mugshot in the record, I would never have been misidentified. So here I am. And then at some point, you know, I said, look, I don't want to wind up dead. I don't want to wind up in prison. So I left New Orleans. I wind up in a Job Corps in Portland, Oregon, Mount Hood. It was something about being on Mount Hood that gave me that peace. And then two detectives came to Oregon and said, Calvin, they got a warrant for your arrest. We got to bring you back to New Orleans, a stand trial. I tried to explain to them that they got the wrong person, but then I went back. I was 19. And I got to New Orleans, and they put me on this unit of guys that had already had the death penalty. Some of them had life sentences. Some had long sentences. And I'm telling them that I didn't commit the crime. And they were saying, look, man, you're going to get the death penalty. Why? You got the same lawyer I got. Same prosecutor I got. And same judge. I went to trial before a judge that had 6 felony jury trials in one day. And then he said, besides that, the victim in your case is white and the witness in your case is white. Man, they're going to execute you. So I'm like, okay, well, how can I help myself? Because I'm used to doing that. He said, well, this is what you got to do. You got to become a lawyer. I only had between an 8th and 9th grade education, and they're telling me that I had to be a lawyer to try to prevent from being executed. But we didn't have any legal material. But I'm going, you know, now I'm told what I have to do. No legal material, and I used to be so happy when wealthy people got arrested. I was, because they always put this newspaper clipping in the newspaper article. They always talked about the law, and I started creating my own law book. But that wasn't good enough. A lot of wealthy people wasn't getting arrested fast enough for me to learn the law that I needed to learn. So I said, okay, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to ask the court to give me a law book. And before you is a motion. So I'm gifting all you all with this motion for a law book. And I sent that to the court. And the court said, look, Calvin, you sent it to the wrong court. You should have started at the bottom. But I was determined to learn the law, and I fell in love with the law. And I would read these articles, and I didn't these cases, and I knew, you know, prior to life before, I wanted to be a thug, wanted to be a mad teacher. And now I'm in prison, I want to be a lawyer, and I'm going to study law. I'm going to learn how to be a lawyer. I wanted to think like a lawyer, walk like a lawyer. I wanted lawyer glasses. Really. And so I started learning, and I learned that I had to figure out what there have to be more people than me was in an oppressed situation, and how did they act? What did they do? And I read about, you know, the Bill of Rights. You know, some people might, and I said, well, those people back then, fellas, though, whatever we say about them, whatever we think about them, that's not the issue. They thought that if they could develop a system or they could create some laws to make sure that nobody ever oppressed them in life, and they come up with the Bill of Rights. And then I'm not educated, but I'm learning. And this is what I learned. I learned that, whoa, half of the Bill of Rights was introduced to protect people like me. The Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, the Sixth Amendment, the Eighth Amendment, and the First Amendment, right? The access to the court and the right to petition the government. These are the protection that those people back then felt as though that if they could just get these things, they would never be oppressed. And they thought, and they knew that the person that was going to need the most protection was going to be people like me, people arrested for crimes, whether they committed the crime or they didn't. So now I got it. Now I have to learn how to wield this power that they gave me back then. And I had to learn the law. So I always looked at law as like a military soldier. If I could wield that power, and also I'm a Lord of the Rings fan, you know, I could just get it. And I started studying, and I studied, and I studied. And then I really fell in love with the law. And I wanted to be the one to learn how to take those Bill of Rights. Not all of them. The Second Amendment don't need no protection. They got a lot of them. And then the First Amendment, right, free speech, they got a lot of lawyers for them. But I needed to learn how to protect those other ones that affected people like me. And I did everything in my power to learn the law. And I got pretty good at it. In the book, and I'm not trying to sell my book, but it tells the story, it's a beautiful story, how it was my mission to take this powerful tool to help people that could not help themselves. And here I am, couldn't even pronounce the law. And I'm going to share a brief story. I went to court one day. I just filed a lot of 1983 actions. I thought I was a civil rights lawyer. And I went to court. I said, Your Honor, I filed this motion to stop the jail attorney from trying to impeach my credibility. I don't know what all that stuff means, but my credibility and all that stuff. He said, well, what's the name of the motion? I said, you got it. He said, what is the name of the motion? I said, Your Honor, it's the motion of lying. Motion of line. And then the clerk came and said, Your Honor, it's the motion of limit. I said, that's the motion that I'm talking about. And she denied the motion. But despite all of that, it was my mission. I wanted to be a lawyer. I wanted to be the one to wield that power. And fast forward, God bless us, they sent the intern to prison. And we explained to her that we couldn't get our records. I could get records from every parish in Orleans, but in Louisiana, but one parish I couldn't get our records. That was the criminal district court in New Orleans. I couldn't get those records. Fast forward, this intern named Emily Bolton, she came, she said, look, once I graduate, I'm going to come help y'all, because we explained to some of us innocent, and some of us not innocent, but we wasn't afforded a fair trial. So she promised that once she graduated, she was going to come and help us. And I'm telling these stories because she was a third-year law student, and she started helping us. And then fast forward, I got out of prison. I got out of prison January the 7th, 2011. Again, I knew what I wanted to be. As a matter of fact, I had some lawyer shoes, and I held those lawyer shoes for so long. Those were the shoes that I was going to walk out of prison with. And as I got to the front gate when they was releasing me, they started clapping, coming apart. They had dry riding on me. That's how long I had them. And I took, there's a picture with me with holding one shoe out in my hand, and I got out of prison. And I knew what I wanted to be. I wanted to be a lawyer. But they told me that in order to practice law on the outside, I had to go through this thing they call boot camp. That is, I had to go get my undergrad. I got out on a Friday. I was on Tulane campus that Tuesday, figured out how to go to law school. And then everybody was saying, well, Calvin, you can't go just go to law school. You got to do this thing they call the undergrad. What is undergrad? So I did it. And then after that, they said, you just can't. You got your undergrad. Now you got to do this other thing. You got to take this LSAT. Oh, wait, see, whoever created that test, something is wrong with that person. Serious, something is wrong with that person. And I took it, and I was slaughtered. I think I probably got one right, and that was my luck. But they didn't say I had to pass it. They just said I had to take it. This is a form of boot camp. I got to get to where I can wield this power that I need to get. So I took it. And then I applied to some of the more, and the score was so, my LSAT score was terrible. And everybody was saying, Calvin, you're not going to get in those schools. I said, watch, man. So I applied to Harvard. I applied to Princeton, Yale. I took big ones. And in that application, I started it off, I am so tired of illegally practicing law. And the place where my life ended was in Oregon. They accepted me, Lewis and Clark. And I went to the law school. I was 57, graduated, got my JD at 60. And I came home. But prior to all that, I went to the clerk in New Orleans, tried to get records. I couldn't get it. And I said that the people that work here do not know how that is affecting our lives. But the only way to change it, I had to be the clerk. And I had to go get myself right. I had to go. I didn't want nobody to say I wasn't qualified. So that's when I went to the boot camp thing, the undergrad, the LSAT. And I came back after getting my JD. And I always say, whenever this office become available, I'm going to run for it. And I did. I came home. The book was released on a Thursday. And that Friday, I learned that the office, the position was available, and the day that day was the deadline, and I was 2 hours from before the qualification ended. So me and a bunch of friends, we ran to the courthouse. I still had my grass cutting clothes on, and I qualified, and all hell broke loose. My job was to become over that court, to make sure that nobody experienced what I experienced. And God bless me, we won. 68.2% of the votes, we won. And then we won. A lot of people attacked me. But my goal was, I have to, people that's running this office did not know. They did not know how it was affecting us. And I won, and if I have enough time, I could share with you all what happened. But while in prison, my job, once I got to Angola, again, I knew what I wanted to be, a lawyer. I applied for the job. I was assigned, I eventually was assigned as debt row. For 19 years, I was assigned to help people that were sentenced to debt, because in Louisiana, If you're lucky enough to get the death penalty, you're lucky enough to get a lawyer. But if you ain't lucky enough to get the death penalty, you don't get a lawyer. Only thing you get is a person like me, a jailhouse lawyer, that want to be a lawyer, that practicing law. People always say, well, y'all couldn't do that because that's illegal. What y'all was doing was illegal. It's an illegal practice of law. And I'm always saying, what can it do us? And then I go forward and I said, do you know this case? You went to law school. I said, you know this case they call Gideon versus Wainwright? Yeah. And I asked him, what was Clarence Gideon? oh, I said, he was a jailhouse lawyer. Gideon was a jailhouse lawyer. And he succeeded. So while in prison, trying to help people get access to the code, and we function just like lawyers. Just like lawyers. I'm sharing this story because sometimes I run across lawyers that's not excited about being a lawyer no more. They're so obsessed with what other people are doing. It's like, no, we got some power with us. So in prison, I done learned, got to wield this power. And I'm helping people, sentenced to debt. I'm 19 years, I'm on debt row. And I'm going to give you an example. One guy case, his name is Juan Smith. He had 5 life sentences and 3 death penalties. Total 8 murders, convicted for 3 of them, he got the death penalty. It was no doubt that the 5 life sentence cases caused the jury to convince the jury to give him the death penalty. But the problem was I couldn't get Juan case. And I read his appeal, and I said, Juan, I can't get your record, but look, I read that direct appeal. I'm telling you, that prosecutor had evidence in his possession, and they didn't turn it all over. And Juan said, man, I'm telling you, I didn't commit those 5 life sentence cases. But he wasn't entitled to a lawyer. Because he had 5 life sentences. He was entitled to a lawyer on a death penalty case. So here I am, the jailhouse lawyer, want to be a real lawyer, and I'm trying to figure out what can I do to help Juan. He got this deadline. If he misses deadline, he's going to get executed. So I say, his lawyers kept telling him, I'm going to file it for you. I'm going to file for you, Juan. I said, Juan, we getting close. I'm not letting you miss your deadline. I don't care what them lawyers say. They're not here. You're going to get executed. So I did what I had to do. I prepared an application, and I said, look, Juan don't have these records, but I know that prosecutor had them records. He had some records that if the jury would have heard this suppressed evidence, it's somewhere there. They wouldn't have found them guilty. Reasonable probability of a different outcome. And I sent the motion to post-conviction, and we filed it. Now they're trying to execute him. His lawyers didn't go get those records, and bingo, the case went all the way to the United States Supreme Court, the 5 life sentence cases. Once his lawyers went and got those records, it showed by 8-1 vote, United States Supreme Court ruled in his behalf. And say that had the jury heard this evidence, they would not have found them guilty. And those 5 life sentence cases was vacated, and then they vacated his 3 death penalty, and he was saved. Why do I tell Juan's story? Thank you. Why do I tell Juan's story? With hardly no resource, none, not even a hunch, I knew they had it. I knew they had evidence because I read that opinion, and with a 9th grade education, it didn't make no sense. And my last story is the Ramos. Now I'm out of prison. I know what had affected people's lives in prison. One of them was the non-unanimous jury verdict. Louisiana and Oregon, my 2 states. You could get convicted without all of the jurors agreeing. And one day, I didn't understand it. I would litigate it in prison. And I always would say, that case, that Apodaca case, it's wrong. They knew it was wrong. It didn't make sense to them. It didn't make sense to the professors, nobody. And when I got out, I learned that it was introduced for the sole purpose of preserving white supremacists. And I saw the damage that it did. Some of my innocent friends, they would never have been found guilty had that law didn't exist. My jury was unanimous. So I ran across an article that educated me once I got out that it was based upon the preserved white supremacy. And I went to a lawyer. And I said, look, this law was based upon white supremacy. And Ben was like, well, Calvin, he didn't embarrass me. Like, Calvin, you're telling me something I already knew. I didn't know, though. So I started. He said, Calvin, if you find the cases, we'll litigate them. And I had to go to Mordo. I ain't go to Mordo. I'm a Lord of the Rings fan. And I went and found those cases. And we litigated those cases. And year after year, I'm telling the Supreme Court, Y'all made that decision in Abadake was wrong. Did you know it was based upon white supremacists? And they deny us. And then I put another one and another one. Our 23rd petition, Supreme Court said, we're going to hear this case. And God stepped in and we won. Now, why do I tell that story? I saw an injustice. I armed myself with the most powerful tool that this country could ever give anybody. And I wielded it for people that could not help themselves. And God intervened and we won. And so I'm always telling that story briefly. Is we have power. We have a lot of power. Ask the other side. They think they run in the country. And they bold, they walk like them, you know.
They walk like them. They know they got the Second Amendment. I ain't got nothing against the Second Amendment.
They know they got all this stuff going. They know they got this concept of federalism on their side, finality. They got these things that uses to crush people. But what we have these other Bill of Rights that say that all citizens are entitled to these things. And it's our job to stand up and do for people that can't do for themselves. So fast forward, I'm out of prison. I knew that clerk office was causing so much harm. And I said, I'm going to run for office. Now, what's the odds of me winning? Very slim. And God bless it, and I won. And then the powers of be said, no, we can't have Calvin. Because we still got that tool in our box that we used during Reconstruction. And we could use it. So my government in Louisiana used that power that still lurks in the shadows from Reconstruction and said, I know what we're going to do with Calvin. I'm going to abolish his seat. I'm going to do away with it. And they did. They did away with the seat. Disenfranchised everybody that voted for me. They just took it. And guess what Calvin did? Oh, I sued. You definitely sued. I continue to do what I always did through the light of justice. I go to the court and I find people records. I monitor everybody direct appeals to make sure that they never fall in the gap to get procedurally barred. I answer their mails. I try to close those gaps that is causing so much harm to people in litigating their cases. And some people say, why do you do that? And I'm always saying, you know something? I got the best boot camp training that anybody could ever, that a lot of other people have. And I give presentations to kind of remind us that we have the same training. I don't know how y'all felt about going through undergrad. I know I didn't. I liked it. I like being with them young kids. They smarter than me. I'm going to play like I'm smart, too. We took the LSAT together. They all, you know, they nervous. I'm happy just to be here. They got their scores. They was higher than mine. And we got to law school, and all of us gone crazy. We depressed. We what do you call that? Imposter syndrome. And I'm like, I've been faking it till I make it all my life. So this is good for me. And they sweating, and I'm sweating. I'm kind of encouraging them. Look, we could do it. They said, but, man, I couldn't get this clerkship job. I said, but you could be a librarian. You could come work with me. You go get people records. In my presentation, I'm going to end with this. And I'm quite sure we're all lawyers. Or aspire to be lawyers. We have tools, too. And we could use those tools. Half of the Bill of Rights was directed to helping people accused of crimes, whether they're guilty or innocent. And I'm never going to let no new administration change my ideal about that. And I generally tell law students that if that don't help you pick up that sword like in The Lord of the Rings, fighting for Middle Earth, and always say it's worth fighting for. I tell law students that even if that don't convince you, think about how much debt they put us in to get this education. And that should really anger us, that every day I'm going to go find somebody that needs some help and trying to convince judges. Once I learn that there's a law out there that's causing so much harm, I'm gonna end with this. So a guy, his name is Ed. I called him Ed. Ed, Republican, was a prosecutor. Ed Tarpley. Ed said when he learned that what the non-unanimous jury verdict was introduced for and was causing, the harm that it was causing, and he was a former prosecutor. He said when he learned that, he vowed to his wife that he's going to spend the rest of his life making sure that that law get off the books. And Ed went at it, and we got it changed. My message is always this. When we see a law that is causing harm, it ain't somebody else's job to bring it to the court's attention and to keep on saying it's wrong. It's our job. And I don't care how many times they defeat us on it. That was our 23rd petition. Everybody kept saying, Calvin, it ain't going to work. And I'm like, yeah, okay, we're going to see. We got to keep on pushing the envelope. We got to keep on telling them that this law is causing harm. This law is causing harm. This law is not working. This law is causing this to happen. This is affecting these people with the hope that one day God would intervene. In Denzel movie, he always was telling his students, the great debater, that who is the judge? He said, who is the judge? And he always said, God is. The student would say, God is. And God is the judge. And he said, why? He's the judge. I said, and then, the response was, because he decides who wins or lose. Thank you all. I hope I wasn't too long-winded. And that's my introduction. Thank you.
So we have about 25 minutes, so be thinking if you've got questions, but I have some questions. So I know Ruben, 15 years, long time, interviewing about 250 people, and if you've read the book, it's fantastic in terms of the dialogue that you have, but is there something that, through that process, that decade plus, that you learned that surprised you or sort of contradicted what you thought you would learn as you went through?
Yeah. For me, the big new lesson in doing the work was to pay attention to the dynamic lives that people find and make for themselves. And I think this is a good pivot to Calvin. Like, the world that you all made inside, for example. The community that you found of folks who had need and also like had gifts and the ways that people shared among themselves. I mean, that's not the stuff that we're taught. Like if you read through the literature, the criminological literature, we're not taught about the ways that ten brothers with a old typewriter figure out how to take on the state and win a case at the Supreme Court. Like we don't learn about that and those sorts of things. When I would see those sorts of things over and over and over again, and then I guess one more example of something that was new and interesting was there's a lot of discussion about loss and grief and the harm that's caused on the inside, but thinking about the dynamic life. So for example, family separation was a giant issue. From my guys and in my book certainly, but I would hear the brothers inside talk about things like having to watch their children grow up through family pictures, but it was always striking to me that they would get the pictures. They would establish relationships with people on the outside. So I learned how porous the prison was, how things on the outside would make their way on the inside, and how they'd be able to mark those important dates, birthdays, et cetera. People wouldn't get visits, but somehow they'd have connection to people that they care for. And I found that striking, extraordinary, beautiful, and not surprising is the wrong word, but just important.
So, oh, yes. Oh. Hi, thank you. That was pretty good. I came in a little bit late, but boy, it's amazing. And do you do other speaking engagements? But that's not my question. All right, the advent of AI. I was just at a CLE this morning where everybody's saying, oh, too many pro se litigants. They're flooding the courts. And to me, it's a great access to justice opportunity, considering how many people in the country can't afford a lawyer. So how do you see the future working out that way? And do we need to work on access to AI tools, particularly for drafting and other things for pro se litigants, both inside and outside the system? Thank you.
That's a good question. So I would say to those people that do not like pro se litigation, people in prison trying to access to the courts, and I guess they probably don't even know who Clarence Gideon is, because he was a person in prison. And so I generally say to those people is that I kind of agree that people in prison shouldn't have to be forced to do those things. That we have a million lawyers out here, hundreds of lawyers that could volunteer and say, I'm going to go in those prisons and I'm going to provide access to the court for those people. That is, to me, the most realistic and rightful thing, because we have trained to do that. People in prison like me, we suffer with all kind of mental stuff. We trying to survive in that environment, but some of us say because we don't have the help on the outside, if for the most part, we do have pro bono lawyers. But so I'm always telling people that say about pro se litigation, that's an easy fix. Get a law passed that says that people in prison should never have to be forced to represent themselves, that we're going to appoint them a lawyer. And if the law does not do it, that we're going to do it on our own. We're going to volunteer. Nobody in prison pays me. Those cases we took to the United States Supreme Court, those 23, nobody in prison had to pay for it. Because I know that a person in prison shouldn't have to be forced to try to, enjoy these liberties that everybody else got that gets this because they have money. So my thing to those, to any of those individuals, I kind of agree. So now what we do, now we're going to go in there and provide pro se, we're going to volunteer our service to help those people. That's my response. And I'm always thinking, the Bill of Rights is for everybody. It was for people. But I'm quite sure that the people that wrote that envisioned somebody actually going in prison to help us, and we won't have to do this ourselves. I don't know if that answered your question.
Thank you. Calvin, I don't use AI. Like I don't use it. Have you not like as an ethical stance, which some of that is, but just I'm not sophisticated enough.
Yeah.
Have you used it and have you found it? Do you think it could be helpful for like the drafting of cases and stuff like that?
Well, people in prison, we barely get mail, so I think the people that come up with that straw argument, I call it a straw argument. They don't even want us with a cell phone.
Yeah.
Didn't you get disciplined for wrongfully using Westlaw or something? Yeah, too,
I went
in prison?
To prison with three write-ups. Well, my last write-up, I went close to 20 years without a disciplinary infraction. My last write-up was for unauthorized access to Westlaw. So,
which he had access to. They just said it wasn't authorized.
Yeah, they just gave us too much information, and I'm using everything that I can get. So I don't know if that answers. Yeah, it's going to be hard for people in prison to get access to AI. It's hard for us to get legal mail. Mm-hmm. But I have used AI. But I just like being a lawyer. I like going to the books. I like going to the library. As a matter of fact, in law school, they was thinking about getting rid of those books. But I had with accommodation, and they had to keep those books.
Oh, there it is. Yeah.
And when I graduated, I was taking my family to the campus, and guess what they was getting rid of? The books. I said, I might go through law school again to get the books.
So you both have talked about... people come out of prison, right? They get to start over. They've been released. But are they really? Because, Ruben, you talk about these invisible strings and maybe not so invisible because there are laws. And, Calvin, you said you walked out with $28 and that
$10.
$10.
$10 check.
Talk to us about some of those invisible strings, both inside and outside, that and this notion of people have done their time and they're released. Are they really?
Yeah, maybe I'll start, Calvin, and tee it up. I'll say no. We're not. I don't think we're in a country where you do the crime, you do the time, and then that's it. No, that 19,000 labor market restrictions. 19,000. There are whole categories of employment for which people can't apply, and a deep expectation that they be law abiding. You know, what I appreciate very much is Calvin, your position that if you see something wrong, you should change it. I think that in regards to the law, I think policymakers should take an approach like medical doctors do, to do no harm. And there's just so many regulations, sanctions, restrictions that in fact do harm. You know, there's 100 years of criminological research that tell us that limited access to employment, that limited access to health, to care, to allow people to stabilize their health and well-being, that pro-social relationships, that these things, that when you have limited access to positive peers, people like mothers, grandmothers, et cetera, that produces crime, that these are criminogenic factors. In fact, on risk assessment scores, all these questions get asked to figure out what are the criminogenic factors. What we've done is we've legislated criminogenic factors. So I think it's a giant problem that needs to be addressed. I think it must be addressed legally, but I also think it must be addressed interpersonally. What are your thoughts about coming home?
Well, I kind of best describe it with not going back to the Bible. When God freed the children of Israel, as soon as he freed them, they were thinking about what? Food,
yep.
Shelter, clothing. Security, community. Well, when they release us, the thing, for my case, for 28 and a half years, I never had to worry about where I was going to get food from, clothes, community. I never had to worry about that in prison. And now I'm out. Those are the things that consume everybody's life on the outside. Now it takes a while. And furthermore, the trauma, prolonged trauma in prison. I think we are very smart that we know that constant trauma from childhood before prison, and then getting out, and then people telling you in prison, Calvin, you could do whatever you want to do. You could be a lawyer, you could be this, you could be an LGR, and you could be a Muhammad Ali. And then when you come home, society tells us you can't be none of those things.
Yeah.
And that trauma. So I know that we are smart enough to know that when a person goes through life with all of that constant, what it does to the brain, we smart enough to know that. So what is the real thing? We provide jobs.
Yeah.
We provide jobs. If I was a lawmaker, one of the things I would tell, I would go to Congress, I'd say, we got to create some jobs. And it can't be on the back of poor people. We can't keep providing. Building prisons, and once we build them, they're going to provide jobs for this community, but we got to get the people from somewhere. In Louisiana, we get them a lot from New Orleans. So I would think that if we just could start thinking about how can we create jobs other than using people for those reasons. That's what I think about. It's hard when you come home, really. It's hard. Some of my friends, they used to tell me when they were to come back, Calvin, it's hard out there. I didn't confront that until actually when I got out. And so one of the things I did was, a group of us, we created the first reentry program in New Orleans called the First 72 Plus. First 72 hours that you're home, we got you. Again, seeing things, I'm not going to put that burden on the people that's coming home, that's all, traumatized, for constantly in there, coming home, not having a community. I'm not putting a burden on them. Pull yourself up. Mm-hmm.
what can we do? We created some reentry programs, and they're working pretty good.
And Ruben, I know in your book you talk about some of the laws that are out there that are hindering people when they get out, had good intentions from the lawmakers. So we've got a room full of lawyers here. Do you have thoughts and ideas of what people can do when people who think they're doing the right thing, the consequences from those laws is what you found out, is what you talk about in your book?
Yeah. Before you answer that, for the lawmakers, it would be a good policy for y'all to ask people that them laws going to affect.
Yes.
Straight
yes.
off.
Yes.
When they passed those laws in the 90s under Bill Clinton, under this stuff, one of the things, if you got a drug offense, you can't rent an apartment.
Yes.
You can't get government assistance. And I know nobody thought that was a good law. But so my point is, you could always go and ask people that if we do this, how is this going to affect you?
Yes.
That's a start. Because none of them laws, if I can't come, I called one time. And I said, look, I want to rent an apartment. He said, well, how long you been out? I said, I've been out 5 years. He said, no, you have to be out seven years. Right. I said, what am I doing in the meantime? Live under the bridge and then right. constantly get arrested? But they have those laws. And then, no.
Right.
How about food?
Right.
You know, I wish the lawmakers ask somebody. Go, you can ask me, Calvin. If we only give you a $10 check, how far that's going to get you? I'm going to say it's going to get me. They're going to bring me to the bus. I'm going to cash the check, spend $7 to take it to New Orleans. I have $3 left. That's how far it's going to get me.
Absolutely. No, I couldn't agree with that sentiment more. And I think there's an easy way to involve people who've been directly impacted by the law and policy apparatus. What I write about is a supervised society that we've built, and that's getting in contact with organizations run by, led by, and that support people with criminal records. I mean, in New Orleans, there's Vote. You know, nationally, there's a wonderful organization called Just Leadership USA. You know, if you're on the West Coast, you could connect with All of Us or None. You know, Susan Burton has this incredible shop. There are all these wonderful activists who do incredible work who have been directly impacted. And these are the folks that we need to bring into the room. I think the places, and also government has been fairly responsive in the last few years. I mean, so I remember under the Biden administration, HUD, for example, was thinking about fair housing, considering the fact that one has a criminal record. And they were looking at some of the innovations in cities like New Orleans, for example, that that has recently passed something like it, or what do you call it, the protected status.
Yeah, in New Orleans, yeah.
Yeah.
That the government cannot refuse to hire. You know, when we put in an application, they can't automatic disregard, say no because you've been to prison.
Yes.
Yeah, but that's what I wish that lawmakers do, because, you know, this is not a movie to me. I actually experienced this.
Yes.
I talked to people about what was happening in a courthouse. Why y'all wasn't mailing us the decisions? And some of these Supreme Court decisions, like one case from the Supreme Court tell us the guests had a claim. It's like, who did y'all talk with? Y'all enacted a law that's going to destroy. And in my book, they enacted a law in 1990 to bar all of us in court, every last one of us. And we brought this to the attention to the warden. And the warden, like, whoa. He has to comply with the law, but that warden said, I tell you what, I'm going to help y'all meet this deadline. Mm. They shut the whole prison down, and we went throughout the prison to meet everybody's deadline. But the person that introduced that law never knew that we wasn't getting the records from New Orleans, and all of us got barred. I even got barred. Had to take a deal to get out. So I'm glad you asked that question. If lawmakers in here, my number is 504-616-8964. You could call me. And we can ask these questions, that if we pass this law, how is it going to affect us? And I'm gonna shut up. When they abolished this seat that I won, that God blessed me with, I begged the legislature, if you don't like Calvin, that's fine, but don't do it to the,
right.
the people that voted for me. Don't discourage them. And it was like, oh, we didn't think about this. But we got orders. We got to do this. But ask questions. ask, just ask questions. You know, just ask, ask, ask. And I hope we get into practice. And one of the things I definitely, before our time run out, I always wish that I had this opportunity to address lawyers, especially bar association lawyers. And my request, first, the gift. You can get involved by helping, you know, the light of justice. But what I would always ask, what I would ask from everybody, help us. The jailhouse lawyers is your brothers and sisters. We litigate the same issues without education, with trauma. Help us. Don't just complain that you got too many cases on your docket. I hear judges say there's too many. Well, quit. Get somebody that's enthusiastic about it. You're a judge. You took the seat to rule on hard cases. You should be happy. That's a privilege. I would ask that all of you all consider, especially just as a foundation, help your brother and sister that's trying to get access to the courts. That's like me being a military man and then saying, look, Kevin, we're going to Germany and we're going to help the English. No, we're going to join up. That's our brothers, and we're going to fight with them. My request to you all is, we shouldn't have to be fighting this demonic system. We got a good system. We got some demonic people willing, some demonic stuff. We shouldn't have to be doing this alone in prison. Because everybody in this room has been, I always go, boot trained to do this. People in prison, we trying to do it. And we shouldn't have to fight these battles like on the Lord of the Rings. We shouldn't have to fight for Middle Earth. That is, the joy, the liberties that everybody else enjoy. It ain't got nothing to do with the crime. We shouldn't have a system where we need to incarcerate people to provide jobs. But you all, no disrespect, and some of you all might be doing that, but that should be a movement among lawyers to go help. Help the people in prison that's trying to provide other people with access to the courts. I want to be a lawyer to help people. And people in prison need lots of help. And that's my request from you all. And that's one of the reasons why I came. Not just for the long flight, the good food, you know, you know, like, and I got a friend in this audience. I love him to death. He see injustice, and he do something about it. He provide pro bono representation. And that's what we all should do. And I'm telling you, this not fake. I am happy. I am a dude. Yeah, they took my seat. I'm still happy. Because I got the power. I got the tool that I could help people with. And we all have that tool. So I would request that you all, when y'all go to y'all committees, y'all thinking about what the Bar Association could do. One of the things that we should all do throughout this, people in prison should never have to represent themselves ever, ever, ever when we got all these lawyers. If I get up and say one thing, not in here, if I get and do a YouTube video about guns, they're going to have the most powerful lawyers come after me. Tomorrow, they have 20 sheriffs. You've been sued. We should be doing that the same way. We should have that same attitude. We got the 4th, 5th, 6th, and 8th in the 1st. We should defend those like those people are defending the other ones. Thank you all. I don't mean to be hard, but perfect. Thank you all.
Perfect. Do we have one question? Okay, time for one more question.
And I just wanted to say thank you so much. And I was sitting here, if I may share a personal story, my sister had a long struggle with abuse and drug abuse and also getting into domestic violence relationships. And I, as a former social worker turned lawyer and now a law professor, watched her going in and out of jail, trying to get her into rehab, and then she would start to turn a corner and she would get a job offer, and then she would show up and they would say, "Ooh, we just checked your record. Sorry." And she would go home dejected. And she also had children. Watching her try to go to rehab where there's no place where your children could go. So she had to literally sign over custody of her children to my mother and my brother just so she could go into rehab and then come out of that and then try to get housing. Can't get housing. So she has nowhere to go with her children. And just to watch this cycle and watch the way that that then pushed her right back into the challenges that she was having. And then on top of that, to be a social worker and a lawyer and trying my damnedest to get her help and still struggling mightily to be able to help her. But she is now 7 years sober.
All right. Yeah.
She has custody of her children. She just bought a house. And she went back to school, got a master's in social work, and now works to help people in recovery. And I'm
fantastic.
Beyond proud of her.
Yes, thank you.
But to watch people go through that cycle over and over again and to not have help, and I just, like, feel graced by God that I had some little bits of tools to help her. So I just can't even imagine what you did to do that. And I am so inspired to want to go out there and help. I'm sorry. To help others. And as a law professor, I have this great opportunity to hopefully give this message to children, their children to me, to law students, do. So anyway, it was not so much a question as just a thank you for this. And I do have one question, that is, do you have your books with you?
The motion for a law book.
Okay. I might have that signed by you.
That's right. That's right. So maybe that's a good segue since we're right near the end. Maybe I'll give you 2 minutes for each of you sort of to wrap up what you want to leave this audience with because we've talked about a lot of amazing topics today and things that people should be thinking about as they walk out this door. So maybe we'll start Calvin 2 minutes, and then we'll end with Ruben 2 minutes.
Yeah. So how many of you all saw the movie The Bridge of Spies with Tom Hanks?
Mm-hmm. It's a good movie.
I always, if Amazon knew that they could make $1 million off me by how many times I watched that movie as opposed to giving me a subscription, they'll rethink their contract. I watched that movie a lot. The Bridge of Spies, how Tom Hanks took this case. And, yeah, it's just that, you know, how he approached it and how it all ended. He didn't give up on the client, and it all worked out. Read things that encourage you. And if, you know, like The Lord of the Rings, they weren't supposed to win. I know it's just a movie. They weren't supposed to win, but it was worth fighting for, and they won. This is worth fighting. This democracy is worth fighting. That is how it affects people in our legal system. I'm not talking about voting. I'm talking about how it affects us in the legal system. What it's doing to us, that complex trauma over and over, and not putting that burden on. None of us should have the burden pulling ourselves up. Enough people in this country, they have the power. And the last thing was, utilize the tools that you all have. Really, you know that. Our professors poured a lot into us to give us the JD that we have. That, you know, that is a powerful tool. That, you know, if you use it for good, good things happen. But that same tool could be used for bad, and bad things happen. We are gifted. We are gifted with this tool. And enough of us got to say, look, we could use it for good. And for those of the people that using it for bad, they don't have to be our enemies. We just got to show them this is what is happening. This is the harm that it's causing. That's what I. The Bridge of Spies is my Tom Hanks. I like Tom Hanks. You know? Yeah.
I appreciate the movie recommendation. You know, my Amazon and Netflix queue has gotten richer now, you know, because of it. Yeah, I think the thing I leave this conversation with is that we're looking at a giant American problem that have a million ways to intervene, It's a giant American problem that can change, and it can change from whatever point you have power and influence. If you are yourself a legislator, you can push for more just legislation. If you are a lawyer, you can help, you can stand alongside people who need the weight and the power of the law, which is a powerful, powerful tool to change lives directly. If you hire people, you can think about ways to hire folks who have records, which are just so many folks. If you belong to some sort of civic or religious organization, you can talk to them about ways that they can be more inclusive. I think that the lesson from today is that change is possible. Small scale change and massive changes, they're all possible. And I think we all could dig in.
Right. Please join me. This has just been an incredible panel. Thank you to Professor Miller and Calvin Duncan.